This is the Home Tech Podcast, show number 61, recorded on February 2nd. A beautiful Groundhog's Day here in Bellevue, Nebraska. And we've had just a run of about 2 weeks of fabulous weather. Unprecedented for January and February. I was able to log about 90 miles outside during the month of January. That just never happens here in Nebraska. But we know that snow is on the way, and we've got a foot of snow coming over the weekend, so we're going to get pounded. I am your host, Jim Collison, broadcasting live from the AverageGuy.tv studios here in Nebraska. And, of course, we post this each week out at TheAverageGuy.tv. You can contact the show, podcast at TheAverageGuy.tv, or track me down on Twitter. Really is the best way to follow me if you want to know what's going on with the show, like tonight, where I needed to delay the start by 2 hours. And I did that yesterday and today, posted that on Twitter, so you can follow me there. And oftentimes I put the show information in Twitter. Also, if a couple of you let me know, I asked last week if you would let me know if you were using iTunes, and a couple of you responded, so I appreciate you doing that. A little bit later in the show, you made some good comments, and so I'll read those here in a little bit later in the show as well. Always appreciate your feedback on what we're doing. If you are an iTunes listener and you get a chance, jump out into iTunes and leave a comment for the show. That, of course, always helps with our show rankings. We also have all the links that you ever need to download the show automatically. Maybe you don't do it to bring it down to your phone or to your iPod, but we have links out there, iTunes and RSS feeds alike. Just go out to theaverageguy.tv, look on the right-hand side, and you'll see the links available to you. If you need help with that, you can send me an email, podcast@theaverageguy.tv. Late start tonight. Guys, I appreciate you hanging out with me to do this. Once every 7 weeks or so, my good friend from wherever he's at tonight, seems like, moving around the country, Chris Lux, is with us. Chris, how are you doing this evening?
I'm doing just fine. Actually, you caught me in Ann Arbor, Michigan tonight. But if you'd asked me on any given day in the last 2 weeks, it could have been any of about 12 different cities. I've been on the road interviewing for Pediatric Hemonc Fellowships, and basically been flying to a new city about every other day. So,
are you back and forth, or do you have it kind of?
No, it's all been a linear string. So I went from St. Louis to San Francisco to Seattle to Baltimore to Cincinnati to Ann Arbor, and tomorrow morning I'm heading back to St. Louis. Ready to be home for a little while.
Yeah, I bet you are. Probably good to get off the road. And these interviews all day type deal? Or
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah, usually start around 8:30 and go to 4:30 or 5, depending on where I'm at. So, it's been really exciting. I've gotten to see some awesome places, and we've got some pretty amazing research going on in this country right now. And everyone's a little nervous that they're going to start cutting the NIH budget. And so that's got people a little concerned about the science priority starting to dip a little bit in the country. But hopefully the budget slashers won't hit us too hard.
So. Yeah. Chris, what's kind of the coolest thing? You know, of course, you know, you're a home tech guy with us. You like all the gadgets and such. But in the medical field that you're currently in, what's kind of the coolest tech gadget? And that I use gadget loosely, right? Maybe the coolest technology that you're seeing go on in the medical field?
I think the coolest technology is the ability to create viral vectors that we can transplant genes or really do gene therapy. We're able to take a gene into a virus that we've built to make it safe and then put it into a group of cells. That virus will integrate that gene into the genome. And then you can put those cells back into a person. And, you know, we've had some of the tools to do that for the last 10 years or so, but there were some initial hiccups in that, and there were some people that were, there were people that died because of unexpected consequences of the way we used to do the gene transfer and gene therapy. And we're about to enter an age where we're able to do this much safer, and we've been able to vet some of these processes, and we're about ready to start basically genetically repairing people and curing them of diseases that were otherwise uncurable before.
That's crazy. Does the increase in processor power that, you know, over the last 10 years we've seen, you know, the processors get, and I don't want to say exponentially faster, but Moore's Law does kick in. Does that help in with, certainly there's got to be a large amount of processing that goes on with this kind of...
Not so much for making vectors. I think where we're seeing processors, I'm trying to think. You know, a lot of it just has to be with how creative you are. I'll tell you a very cool place where processors are powerful is I saw a presentation of a group that's trying to create small molecule inhibitors that go between a receptor and its ligand. The ligand is the piece that latches onto the receptor. And they're making little molecules that fit into the little molecular notch. So you've heard of all the folding at home things where people can
fold
proteins.
Right.
So we know how these proteins fold now, and we know what the pockets look like where these things interact. And so they're basically creating little perfectly matched plugs that go into the receptor site, and then the another one that covers over the key. So basically you're filling the lock and you're covering the key. And even if neither one of them is particularly effective at what it does, now you're kind of interfering a little bit with both sides, and you're able to kind of inhibit some pathway that may be running a little bit too fast in someone. So
wow.
There's a lot of really cool things like that, and that would require a lot of processor power.
Yeah, to figure all that out. That's very cool. Well, Chris, it's always great to have you on the podcast. Thanks for coming back.
Thanks.
Speaking of smart guys, Christian is off for the night and had a lot of homework, and so his evil twin, actually his dad, always steps in Christian's absence. Gary, how are you doing this evening?
Just fine, Jim. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for being the pinch hitter for him. You're a good fill-in. He's talking maybe some NASA stuff over the summer. Anything work its way out with that?
Yeah, I'm hoping he's about ready to hit a home run here. The NASA funding, just like the NIH funding, is a ball that's constantly up in the air, and they've gone through quite a few cutbacks. So the anticipated program that he wanted to apply for an internship this summer was canceled, and they redirected him to Langley Research Center in Virginia, and he took the initiative to contact the IT department directly and email the coordinators of the program at Langley, and they actually invited him as a high school junior to apply for the program that's open to the college juniors.
Nice.
After seeing,
you know what, he's gonna rock their world. Like he's gonna blow those college kids out of the freaking water.
Exactly.
It's gonna be amazing.
Exactly. When he submitted his resume and he had, you know, ASP.NET, C#, Java, SQL, you know, and the list was a page long, and they just came right back and said, by all means, please apply. You know, so.
Yeah.
And then we sat down and we did the application program online. It's like a 14-page application program that he's got to fill out online. And then he found all the bugs in the program for submitting the application and notified them what wasn't working. So he's got everything in. He's got his recommendations in. And we're just waiting with our fingers crossed to hope he gets accepted to that. But real promising. The program he's been invited to is nationally ranked as the sixth most attractive college internship in the country for IT people.
That's great.
So.
Wow. Yeah, good for him. And we are very fortunate to have him almost every week. We're probably 3 out of 4 because of school and some other things, but he gets to join us each week and has got some smart stuff to say. So. Christian, I know you probably won't go back and listen to this show, but congratulations in advance. Even though you haven't got it yet, we know you're going to...
Yeah, we've got no doubts in this crew.
Yeah, yeah, that's for sure. Well, thanks, guys, for joining me. Been a busy day. I mentioned in the pre-show, just a crazy day getting here, but we are here together tonight. Gary, I noticed in the show notes, first thing, you dropped out the SSD word, and we've been talking a lot about SSDs for a while, and I was not an SSD guy for a while, and 2 or 3 weeks ago I put one in, and it seems like I just can't stop talking about it since I put, you know, the SSD drive on my PC. made a world of difference. And really, you know, I'm taking the gospel of the SSD out to the world these days and talking to everybody who says, the second they say, you know, my PC's dragging a little bit, and I'll say, hey, have you thought about an SSD drive? And almost the number one you know, response back I get is, oh, yeah, but they're just way expensive. Not Gary, more. Are you you guys seeing prices come down, Gary? I know you're following those.
Yeah, a couple topics that I wanted to bring up was, number one, that they are falling, and I got two notifications today advertising SSDs for less than $1 a gigabyte. I saw two 120 gigabyte SATA 3 SSDs on sale for $109.99, $110. So, you know, they've come below that $1 per gigabyte threshold, right, which I think is now, you know, when you look at the price of hard drives and compare the price at $109 for a 120 gigabyte drive, you know, ask yourself what size hard drive are you going to buy for $109, and it's just not. I don't think the difference is that far off.
Right. I still think you gotta do the price per gig comparison. You can't equate them, you know, because if you try to say, because probably you'd get a 2 terabyte drive or something for about $109, or you used to be able to.
I'm sorry. What size?
The numbers dropped.
Yeah, there's.
You used to be able to get a 2 terabyte drive for like $100. Right. Yeah. I'm just saying, there was a time when that. Yeah,
right.
So.
Right.
So many of us own 2 terabyte drives that we paid $110 for, and now we're seeing something that's 120 gigs. And I think that some people still say, like, well, it's nowhere near the space. But I think you really do use them differently. I think you, you know, at 120 gigs, you can put a lot of stuff on there, and especially for a laptop or for something like that, it's a great idea to go that route. For the performance game, but it's not going to be a place you're going to store all of your stuff. And I don't think anybody would recommend storing, you know, your entire collection of data on SSDs. So,
right. The reason we talked about a lot about this last week, the reason that we want to monitor this, and it is such a kind of an attractive change in the landscape, is that the hard drive prices have gone through the roof. Since that flood in Thailand squeeze, the 3 terabyte Seagate XT 7200 RPM drive, which I was buying for $149 a pop when I was building out one of my servers, they were the most recent price on them was $429 a drive, and they're extinct. You can't even get them anymore. So.
Okay.
And the model that's replaced that drive is still up around $230. So it's still more expensive than the one I bought. And that's why I was saying, you know, for the average user, the way you're doing things now, if you are going to replace a drive because you think your old drive is a little slower, a little long in the tooth, it probably makes more sense now to go to the SSD and then take that old drive and reformat it for data storage and use your SSD rather than putting, you know, for the boot up, rather than, you know, going for one of these larger drives that are really overpriced today because of the part shortage. So
right
now I think the SSD is the smart buy if you're wanting to upgrade something.
The interesting thing for me with the SSD has just been the way I treat data a little bit different. So I used to just, I'd record these podcasts, and I never even worry about them on my current OS drive because I had, you know, a terabyte or a terabyte and a half of space. And, you know, these podcasts take up, the video probably takes up 300 or 400 megs a podcast. Mm-hmm. And, you know, when you podcast 3 or 4 times a day, I mean, a week, it just feels like a day, you know, they store up after a while. Well, on the SSD drive, I really want to be careful not to let too many of those start to stack up or get to the point where each week I just move them off and I move them on to more, on cheaper storage, so to speak.
Can't you program to record directly to the server storage?
No, the Procaster does not give the option. It only records to the C drive. on the PC. I looked into that. But regardless, I don't mind it recording to that drive, the solid-state drive, the first time. It's changed my habits a little bit. That has made me want to move those files off just as soon as possible. And then where I used to not care about kind of junk stuff on my desktop, I now run that up to the trash and delete it pretty regularly to keep the drive clean. So it has just caused me to just... My PC habits have changed a little bit with that. Chris, do you have you got anything with a solid state drive in it at this point?
Pretty much everything. My home theater PC definitely, and it performs a lot better with the SSD. The menus jump faster, things launch faster. My main desktop at home is SSD. Really the only thing that's not, the home server is not. And just before this trip, I picked up a laptop, and it's not an SSD at this point, but I will certainly consider throwing one in there at some point, but it's plenty fast for right now.
Chris, did on your home theater PC, I've got one in my home theater PC too, and one thing that kind of surprised me is that when my home theater PC comes out of sleep mode, it takes about 2 or 3 minutes before I can actually get to live TV. What kind of TV tuner are you using?
So I've got a HD Home Run, and that thing's been great. It really does do a good job of allocating those tuners out over the network, and I've been able to successfully watch one channel while recording another. And now that being said, I never put my home theater PC to sleep. It's a high efficiency power supply, and it's a fairly low consumption board and processor, so it stays running 24/7.
Okay. I let mine sleep when it's not doing anything, which is rare. But I've got the HD Home Run Prime that I have for serving all our satellite systems on the network, but my home theater's got a Seton card in it with the four tuners, so that's why I'm wondering if maybe it's the Seton card that's taken a while to power up and get those tuners connected to Windows Media Center. But
I
was surprised.
It does seem a little odd, Gary. I'll be honest. That seems a little too long. I mean, mine fires right back up. I put mine to sleep from time to time. I fire that up and go right into Media Center, and it just picks up the home run right away.
Yeah.
I mean, it sounds like a driver issue somehow.
I don't have any problem on the system with my HD Home Run Prime. It's just that the home theater uses the Seton card is installed in there, and it's not using the Prime, so I'm wondering if...
Right.
Maybe delay.
In general, I'm kind of against sleep modes and hibernation modes. I just, for some reason, I find that most machines kind of balk at those, particularly on HTPCs. Like, there's just too many ways it can go wrong. But one thing in all of my troubleshooting with that is that you can go into each device. So if you went into your Seton tuner and your device manager, you can go into power settings and disable or uncheck the box that says turn this device off when the computer goes to sleep.
That way
it may have something to do with the tuner powering on and off when the computer's coming out of sleep. So just make it stay powered on, and it shouldn't add that much more
drain
to your system.
Yep, I'll give that a try.
Cool.
When I put my solid-state drive in, I just removed, because it was on my... desktop, I just removed the hibernation option altogether and turned it off.
Yeah.
And then it deletes
that. Because it takes up a lot of space.
Yeah, it does. It takes up, I have 8 gig of RAM, and so it takes up 8 gig of space.
Yep.
Reserved. Yep. So you can get, you get 8 gig back. When you only have 120 and you use 30 for the OS, 8's quite a bit.
Yeah, just a funny thing with my HTPC computer, I put one of my old green drives, one of my big Western Digital green drives in there to put my Blu-rays on so that they were immediately available to the home theater PC, whether the server was doing other things or not. And oddly, if that thing spins down and goes into green mode and the computer tries to ping it, you can hear it spinning up. And as you hear that long, slow spin up to full speed, the computer just freezes. It won't do anything. And it'll wait, and then it'll kind of like hit that top speed and it's whining a little bit, and then everything works again. So,
so you can kind of, you can hear
it. Doesn't sound right to me either, but it's like,
yeah.
Oh yeah. Yeah. It sounds like, remember the old flashes, like the old flashes on those cameras where you take a picture to go.
Yeah.
Boot up. It's kind of like that sound. So
yeah. Zadler says when he goes to sleep, he likes to take his pants off.
I was just reading that.
Thanks, John. Very nice. Yeah, we were talking about sleep mode, and he says when he goes to sleep, he likes to take his pants off. The thanks for the info, John. I appreciate that. Anything else on the hard drives? I want to move on to the next. Anything else, Gary?
Hard drives, no. I don't think so.
Real quick. So in my hand here, I don't know, the light's maybe going to prevent you from seeing it, but I just got it in the mail. Maybe there. So it's it's my new gigabit switch, 8-port gigabit switch.
Nice.
Came in a really nice compact. And I never know how to pronounce this. It's ZYXEL. How do you pronounce that? ZYXEL.
Zycel? Is how I say it.
Zycel? Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
It touts itself as being a green switch, which is supposed to conserve on the power. But I am kind of anxious. I've been moving a lot of data across the network recently. I do have an old Linksys 8-port 10100 switch that I've been using forever. I don't know, maybe 4 or 5 years now. It's probably outlived its usefulness, and most of the machines have gigabit, with the exception of my Windows Home Server. Version 1, most of my machines now have gigabit network cards in them. You're looking at me funny, Chris.
Yeah, how come you don't have gigabit in your home server?
Because it's an old Dell Celeron 900. I mean, it's an old Dell.
Dude,
I pulled out of my parents'
place. $10.
Yeah, I haven't had a switch to put it in.
I think Jim's still driving like a 1963 Volkswagen too.
Well, yeah, Jim, you always amaze me. Like, you have some of the coolest stuff, some of the coolest toys, and then it's like, oh yeah, and you know, all this huge system is to run like 8-bit games or something crazy.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah. No, it's not that bad, but like it's pretty close. But no, I haven't had a gigabit switch, so I never upgraded the network card in it to it. So
yeah.
But everything else is ready to go. And yeah, this was like $35, so I didn't, you know, I probably could have pulled the trigger on this thing a while back. I finally got around to it, had some money, finally bought it. So it's I'm anxious to see the difference it makes. I've had some network, you know, I was chatting with Rich O'Neill online, and he was like, are you kidding me? You still have 10100? He goes, okay, let's do this experiment. Okay, I'm going to start moving this file, and you start moving a file, and you tell me.
Yeah.
So he's getting this incredible throughput. I'll be honest with you, I don't move a lot of data around my network all the time. I move these 300 or 400 meg files that I make onto the home server. Takes, I don't know, 15, 20 seconds. It could take 3 with the gigabit switch. That to me hasn't really mattered that much. But the more podcasting I've been doing, I have noticed that I'm hoping it'll make a little bit. I think I'm getting throttled some with the 10100 switch on some of the podcast stuff that we do. So I'm hoping that'll change. I'll get that behind the router and get all my internal PCs on it and hoping that'll make a change. So just an update. I know you guys have been razzing me, and no, Mike Howard, I have not bought an Amazon Prime account yet. He's always dogging me to get Amazon Prime. Gary, did you make some subsonic updates?
Well, not really so much updates as we've just been doing a lot more work on it, and I worked with a friend from down in Texas, and I set up a site for him so he could access a site up here on my server and access his music. So he shipped his hard drive up to me, and I put it on one of my servers and set up his credentials on his site, and we've been testing that for a while. So that kind of falls in line with what you were talking about. On a 10100 switch, I'd probably still be waiting for that to be effective, because like today I copied like 3 terabytes worth of data from one server to another, and that took about an hour. So you know, when you start moving a lot of media, video files, big music libraries, a gigabit switch is a real must have. But
yep.
We've had some fun because what I first did was I stored the library on my RAID 50 server, thinking that that would be able to generate the music lists and subsonic real fast for him to get to his cell phone. And what we found out was that even the gigabit switch, because the music was stored on the RAID 50 array, which can put out like 350 megabytes a second. I mean, that 8-drive array is super fast. But the switch was limiting the transfer to the other server. So we found that by actually storing the music on the same server that the site is hosted on, it accesses and gets the music out to the internet much faster, rather than transferring it from the array over the switch. So that was one experiment that kind of shed some light on some of the inner workings of data transfer on the network. And we've done a lot of fun things with it, and we set up FileZilla so that he can upload multiple folders directly to the server and put it in his storage. And one of the main reasons that motivated me to do this was to work on security and isolating his account, his files, and his access just to his portion of where his site is hosted, and making sure that his data and his access were segregated from the rest of my network. So, you know, we've had a lot of fun doing it, and the guy's a very, very interesting fellow. He's got a huge music collection approaching, I think, a little over 200 gigabytes. And he's got a lot of great ideas and techniques for organizing the library, keeping it clean, having the right tags on it, nice album art on it. So it's a really nice, clean collection. And he puts a lot of time into it and uses, Media Monkey to go through a lot of his library and keep the files clean and organized.
Really?
So,
that works pretty well?
It's a good program.
Really?
Yeah, I've used it before too. It's good.
Yeah, so I've learned a lot from him, and I was thinking that maybe down the road we might give some thought to having him on as a guest speaker on keeping music libraries organized and managed, and some of the techniques that he uses, because he really does a nice job of keeping the library clean.
Like weeds in the backyard, I've kind of let mine go, and I know it's probably in a state of disarray. And I just have about 30 gig, so not a lot for the most part. But I'd used Media Monkey maybe a year or two ago. Maybe it's time to come back to it, give it a try again.
Yeah, me too. I
really think it's not something you have to do every day. You know, I think you can run it once every 6 months to once a year. But the thing is, once you get all caught up, as long as each time you get music or you put something on there, you keep it clean. You know, I basically never put anything on there unless I've ripped it straight from the Zune Marketplace, or I buy it from the Zune Marketplace. So everything already has the album art and everything tagged just right. So, you know, I think unless you're getting stuff from other people and sharing stuff, it should be pretty straightforward to keep it in the library.
Yeah, I've moved it around a couple times, Chris, and I think I've let iTunes organize it once, and then maybe Windows Media Center or Media Player organize it, and yeah, that's why it's a mess.
Yeah. Okay.
I just need to have one. I need to spend some time. I know I got some duplicates. I know, you know, I've got some stuff.
Both of those do metadata and album art completely differently. Yeah. So you end up with, like, Apple makes these stupid little, like, thumbnail icon things that hide somewhere else in the folder, and it's a mess. So
yeah.
I always stick with the Zune or Media Player.
Yeah, Media Monkey. Yeah. Yeah, I'll have to give that a go.
Well, that was another fun experience this week, is my wife recently got one of the postage stamp size iPods.
Yeah, the Nano Touch.
And she says to me, "Here, can you put some music on here for me?" "Oh, sure, I could." You know, I don't know. Must be me. Must be getting old. Must be getting set in my ways. But I tried to use. I figured, of course, use iTunes to sync the iPod. It was the most obtuse thing I ever had to go through to get it set up and figure out what the heck I was doing, and I'm still not sure how I would access a large library in the main iTunes library and yet segregate what actually synchronizes with the iPod Nano so that you don't have more than 2 gigabytes going to the Nano at any one time.
You kind of got to do playlists and stuff like that. I'm pretty far out from using iTunes. It's been probably a year since I've touched it, but if I remember right, you have to kind of do playlists and, you know, set all these different rules and things. I'm not a fan of the way I like drag and dropping. I like putting things from a folder into a folder.
Yeah, so, and I guess what surprised me, I've never been an Apple guy or a big iTunes. I just never got really terribly involved with it. But, you know, of course, the reputation of Apple and iTunes is ease of use. So maybe I'm just so much,
you know. Might be, Gary. No, I'm just kidding.
Maybe I'm just so much in a Microsoft state of mind that Apple is a foreign language to me. But
yeah, my kids whip through that iTunes stuff pretty fast. They've all got iPods, with the exception of one. We still have a Zune in our house because of Chris Lux. And they all have iPods and they rip through that stuff pretty quick. They're very utilitarian about it. They couldn't tell you anything about it. They just know how to get the music on there and then they're done. Right, until the next time they want to switch their music around. So where we get into it and obsess about it and talk about it and try and figure it out, they get in there, load the music up, throw the music on the iPod, disconnect the iPod, and they're done.
And they don't even care how it really works.
No, they really don't. They really don't. No, it is a different, it's a little bit different approach to it. And, again, they just want to get to the music. So they come at it from a different perspective. Speaking of iTunes, Chris, we spent last week. Were you with us with Rich when we talked about Windows Phone 7? Windows 7?
Sounds Phone familiar. 7, right? I mean, we've talked about it before, yeah.
Yeah, so what do you know? What about the phone and Windows 8? What's going on with that? What do you know?
Yeah, so there's been a bunch of leaked stuff recently, and I guess enough has leaked now that Paul Thurrott, from Windows Weekly and Super Cypher Windows, has basically now said he can confirm a lot of these things because he's known the answers, but because of NDA. There we go. Thank you. Because of NDAs, he couldn't say these things, but now he's able to tell a bunch of them. And so I think the biggest thing they said was that they have confirmed that Windows Phone 8 is going to be running a version of Windows 8, like the full operating system. Hmm. It's what's going to be the basis for these phones. Now, certainly they'll have scrubbed a lot of the features and things from the whole operating system out of it, but it's going to be a version of the kernel from Windows 8 itself, which to me is very exciting because that means that the phone and your laptop and your desktop and your tablets are all going to be running the exact same operating system. The other thing that's cool about that is that all of the apps that they've written for Windows Phone 7 are going to work natively in Windows Phone 8. They're not going to have to change them at all, which means they're not only going to work on Windows Phone 8, but they're also going to be able to work within the Windows 8 environments, which is kind of exciting. There's a bunch of other little things. They talked about some like companion experiences and SkyDrive integration, and Skype will definitely be a part of Windows 8, and it's supposed to come out for Windows 7 eventually, since Microsoft owns it now. And they're also doing a bunch of things on the backside to make it work better for businesses, which is important because I think they're basically trying to capture as much of the BlackBerry fallout as they can. Although I think Apple's doing a pretty good job of that right now.
Oh yeah, yeah.
So yeah, a lot of cool little things we know about it now, and you know, it's kind of riding a wave of what appears to be sort of some improved success. They were definitely well received. The new Lumias were really well received at CES, and I think they're starting to get some attention. So,
next phone. When's your next contract up for your phone?
Another year.
Okay, and so
that's killing me though. I'm already seeing, like, I love this phone, but I'm already seeing like the Lumia 900 looks amazing to me. That's one other thing is they've talked about they're going to add near field communication, so NFC chips are going to be available.
Which means
Windows Phone 8. So this is basically the thing that It allows you to like tap your phone on a credit card receiver thing and make purchases with it.
Okay.
It allows your phone to know, so you'll be able to take your phone and like, I don't know if you touch it or rub it against another phone or something, but your phones are near each other and it's like, yeah, or you tap it a little bit and it's like, oh, I'm going to give you $10. So they're talking about kind of a mobile wallet thing. So basically you wouldn't have to carry a debit card. You wouldn't have to carry your wallet. You could just kind of carry your phone around and tap it on different things. And you know that really nobody, some of the Android phones I think have NFC in them. Apple has not done that yet, although they plan on doing it in the future. And I think it's just the next phase of interactivity. It'll be one more little radio that's in there.
Yeah, horribly convenient. Horribly convenient to use.
Oh, yeah.
At work, you know, my badge gets me anything, you know, beep at the in the dining facility.
Yeah, I don't see why it couldn't do that, why it couldn't let you get into buildings and be your key to your home and start your car and all that stuff.
Because it's not good from a budget perspective. That's the problem. It's just too easy.
Smartphones really are. Yeah. Smartphones really are.
Yeah.
So
just don't lose the phone.
Right. Well, it'll lock, right?
Most of
my phone locks within 30 seconds of inactivity.
Well, no, that's a good point. I imagine you have to type in your code before you'd be able to buy something. Yeah. At least I'd hope not.
Yeah, I would think so, like the Starbucks app, right? I mean, today on the Android, with the Starbucks app, it's a barcode reader, right? But I have to open the phone and set it to the read and, you know, beep to make the thing work. I imagine
I've been flying everywhere and people are bringing up their boarding passes on their phone. And the guy actually, rather than scanning the piece of paper, he's scanning their phone under the little scanner. And they're able to board the planes with their boarding passes from their phone, which is kind of neat. So,
Are you able? You're not able to do that then, and with your Windows Phone.
I don't know.
No app.
Maybe.
To do
that. I haven't really searched for that. Until recently, I haven't been a big flyer, and I've flown a lot. So,
were you in Seattle?
The other quick thing I was in Seattle, so I just want to say I want to segue. I made a little trip over to the Microsoft store in Seattle. My cousin was driving me around, and she said, "Oh yeah, there's this little mall over there," and I was like, "Oh my God, it's the Microsoft store!" So we went in there, and it's interesting. It's kind of not for us. Kind of like, you know how we said like CES wasn't really for us this year, like it was for the consumers?
Yeah.
That's what the Microsoft store is. It's all the like the stuff that we've known about or seen for the last like 6 months or a year. And there was no Windows 8 stuff. There was, you know, they didn't have the Lumias out yet, anything like that. They didn't have the Kinect for PC out yet, but this was like a week ago, so I'm sure it's there now. So it was an interesting store. They do a nice job of displaying everything and having some really slick computers out. Right now, unfortunately, they're showing the Samsung slates that they gave out at the developer conference, you know, when they announced Windows 8.
Right.
And I picked it up and I was like, God, this is really heavy. And then I looked at the back and there's like the little grate on the back where there's a fan in it, like an exhaust fan on a tablet. And I went up to the guy and I was like, "You guys have any other tablets out here?" And he goes, "No, but these are really advanced and you ought to consider one." And I was like, whoa, no. "These are the ones you gave out at the developer conference." He's like, "Yeah, the developers love them." I said, "Okay, but it's got a fan on it. Come on, you can't sell with an exhaust fan."
I know.
So, they're going to replace all that stuff soon. They're going to do ARM for the Windows 8 tablets and things like that. But it's still – the other thing that's funny about the Seattle Microsoft store is it's directly across the parking lot from the Apple store. And the front of the building, rather than like the gunmetal front of the Apple store, it's like a white ceramic kind of plasticky looking front. And then there's a big like Microsoft logo in the top just where the Apple logo would be. So it's a clear – absolutely clear copycat of what's across the street. And you walk across and look in the Apple store and there's like wall-to-wall people. And, you know, I literally heard somebody say, where's the more expensive version of this? Like they were looking at an item. I think it was like a MacBook Pro, and they were like, "Where's the more expensive version of this? I don't want this one. I want the most expensive one."
I can't spend enough money
and
with you.
That's right.
How do I give you more of my money?
That's right. And I was kind of looking across the street, and there were like 10 people in the Microsoft store, and so as far as consumer excitement goes, you know, Apple still has the upper hand, but.
Chris, do you find that the Microsoft store then is a place you go to just look at the stuff before you go buy it at fries.com or from
No.
Would you actually,
not really. You know,
but I mean, would you actually buy something out of that store?
I'll tell you, yes. And the reason I say that is because the prices were all good or low. So that one of the things I saw was they had a media center style remote for the Xbox that was $20, and I scanned it with my phone and it brought it up on Amazon, and it was the exact same price on Amazon. And they had I would have bought this. You know the Arc mouse, the Microsoft Arc mouse that everybody shows, and it's kind of this funky looking mouse, and I thought, well, why would anyone ever get that? Well, until you see it in real life, you don't realize that it flattens out. You can bend it flat like a plate and stick it into the side bag on your backpack, and then when you pull it out, you like fold it down and it snaps into this nice arc shape, and now you've got like a mouse that takes up a quarter of the space that it normally would. So, you know, that was something you had to kind of see to believe, I guess.
Sure.
So, but in general, it was one of those experiences where I walked in and was like, oh, I'm going to see the latest and greatest, all these cool things. And I walked out thinking, okay. It's just another – it doesn't impress me any more than, like, Best Buy would, you know, which I don't really shop at Best Buy.
Yeah, and, you know, I was in Best Buy just today. I was actually returning some – I bought a video card to try out, and I was taking it back because I didn't like it. And I was – last 15 times we only have a Best Buy, so I'm kind of stuck with it. But they don't have hardly any equipment. I mean, they have really thinned out as far as the stuff that they have available. And they even had a little sign that said, "We're sorry, there's been floods in Thailand, and we don't have as many hard drives as we would normally stock. So one per customer, kind of thing, and or whatever. You know, we're going to limit." And there were literally 3 hard drives. Internal drives. Plenty of external drives. I mean, stocks just full of external drives. 3 internal drives on the shelves, and that was it. So, kind of thin. It's kind of a bummer. I'm taking a Rich O'Neill approach to Best Buy in that I'm going to use their 30-day return policy to try stuff out, and then buy it online if I like it, and take it back. That sounds really bad, but
that does sound really bad.
But it works. I mean, it's one of those kind of things. I went there.
Try this. It works, but you're kind of hosing the company.
Yeah, maybe that's why the shelves are thin. So it's certainly, I think, the state of the big box store here in Nebraska, anyways. At least in the middle.
All right,
of Nebraska,
I won't think too much less of you.
Oh well, thanks, Chris. Thanks. Hey, one more thing. I kind of missed this. I don't know how I did. Did Facebook actually IPO this last week? Have they done that, or is that coming up, or does anybody know?
It just happened.
Yeah, totally missed that. That was today.
Yeah.
Oh,
thought
okay.
So. Yeah. Let's okay.
I don't feel so bad. Any word on how it did? I didn't. I haven't followed. Like I said, I haven't followed it at all. Did it do well? Did it? I imagine it would. What did it open at? And anybody know?
I did read that some people thought that it was a little overvalued based on the slope of the increase of ad revenue as compared to when Google went public, but I didn't see any actual trading activity on it yet.
Do you guys?
So maybe it's happening. Maybe it's happening momentarily. I don't know.
Well, let's talk about.
They filed the IPO yesterday.
Oh, okay. Okay.
I see. Wanting $5 billion for it.
Yeah. Let's 2 hours ago. Facebook filed its IPO yesterday and hopes to raise $5 billion when it starts selling shares.
$1 billion.
Company is said to be considering a $75 to $100 billion valuation. But not everyone is equally impressed with the company. Many high-profile investors have been sounding off on the company since news of the IPO finally broke. Jimmy Rogers, everybody loves Jimmy Rogers, said he won't be buying U.S. stocks. I'm not buying because it's a very expensive stock. That's not the way I invest. So,
yeah.
My sense of it is that after the success of Google, Facebook will probably be overpriced and disappoint those who invest in it initially. If it has a major correction and you see some sustainable growth in ad revenue, you may find a bottom that it's, you know, reasonable to invest in. But I wouldn't jump in early.
So you're going to hold at this point?
Well, I just think if, you know, these things are money makers for the people who sell the shares,
right? Yeah.
As the IPO is taking off, and those are the big guys.
Jim, are we obligated to say that we are not your financial advisors?
Yes.
As a full disclosure, I do not hold any interest in. And
do
Facebook.
Not listen to our
clearly
advice.
None of us are smart enough to make investment decisions. We are either in basements or in
exactly
hotels,
right.
So.
Yeah, I don't know. I'm kind of over it already.
It's filed, but not trading is.
Yeah.
It didn't even happen yet.
I know. I'm already over it.
Before it happened.
I don't know. I don't. Yeah, that's not one that really even. I mean, I didn't even know what was going on. So I know there's people making a big stink out of it, but I don't know. You know, you look at Facebook. It's giant. From a usage standpoint, and of course their primary revenue model is in ads, much like Google is at this point. I don't ever see them making any money any other way, realistically, so I don't know.
Oh, there's lots of ways for them to make money.
There's lots of ways for Google to make money. They're not.
On a positive note, Christian's been working on his website, and in the last month, we've doubled our AdSense revenue. So if anybody's interested in an IPO investment, in the near future, we might announce. You never know.
Now, if Christian announces an IPO, I am all over it. Let me just tell you that. But Chris, what were you going to say?
Is Christian's last name Zuckerberg?
Chris, you were going to say something.
No, but I think his father's name is Zuckerberg.
Zuckerberg.
I get like sucked it. Into all those things. Never make any money.
Well, it interesting to see where Facebook goes. Oh, you had said
what the hell, they can make money. Yeah. Okay, so, you know, people are loading tons of pictures up on Facebook. So, you know, allow people to print their pictures off or make photo books. Sell items there based on people, you know, make a deal with Amazon where if, you know, someone buys something, they can post their purchase on Facebook, and then if a friend buys it, they get 2% of the profit because, you know, it was a friend recommending it to a friend. I think there's a lot of ways for them to make money.
But don't you think that's all things Google tried as well and have hacked most of those businesses out because they didn't really...
Okay, but nobody spends their day. Nobody lives on Google. They do searches and they get off.
That's true.
You know,
that's true.
People sit... I mean, I'm walking around the airports and people are sitting there spending an hour on Facebook. You know,
I think
a lot of people do that. So, yeah, I think there's still a ton of room for them to make more and more and more money. They just they know they have to be cautious in how they change things on Facebook or people will get upset. But it's only continued to grow and grow and grow. So I think there's still a lot of money to be made.
Okay. Well, we'll see, won't we? So speaking of satisfied, Chris, you made you used Gazelle for the first time, and a positive experience for you?
Yeah. Very.
And of course,
yeah.
For folks who don't know, Gazelle is a recycle. You can send your gadgets in. And
so the idea is that especially if it's a product that's, you know, in good shape and still working. So, for me, for example, I had my when I got my Windows phone, I had my old iPhone 3GS. And I saved it initially because I was like, well, I definitely want to back up in case, you know, I either don't like the Windows phone or it breaks or something goes wrong. And after a year of having the Windows phone, I said, you know what? I haven't touched this iPhone in a year, and nobody that I know wants it, so I'm going to check on Gazelle. And it was still worth $100. You know, even being a couple years, actually probably 3 years old at that point, and it was still in good shape, but it had a few little scratches on it. And they gave me $100 for my phone, so I was very happy with it. They paid for the shipping, sent me a box in the mail, and I sent it back to them. And yeah, it was.
Did you go directly through them, or did you go through Newegg?
Directly through them.
Did you compare what that was selling for on eBay?
So I did not.
Okay. I just wondered, you know, it was a comparable price. Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, there's a lot to be said for something that saves you a hassle. I just, you know, wondered if what the comparable
price without going too far into the details, I'm a little at odds with eBay right now.
Okay.
I am a very, generally a very casual eBay. It's not eBay so much as PayPal. I'm a very casual eBay buyer and occasionally seller, and for the first time I tried to sell a larger ticket item on eBay, and there was a mix up in the shipping address, which delayed shipping, and the buyer's credit card company issued a chargeback, which I'd never heard of before. And so just a little general warning to the tech savvy people out there, part of the user agreement with PayPal is that if anybody challenges a sale on any level, they will pull the money back out of your account and hold it, and the process to resolve it, they tell you, can take as long as 72 days. And I'm about 50 days into this challenge process with a very unhappy buyer, and PayPal is just completely silent. There's no indication that they're making any progress whatsoever. And this is completely within their user agreements that they can basically pull the money out of your account. And so I am very dubious to ever use PayPal again after this experience. And when I started searching for PayPal and chargebacks, because I'd never heard of such a thing, there's a lot of people out there that are frustrated with that policy. And I'm definitely adding myself to the list. So.
That's too bad. We use PayPal quite a bit. Actually, through the user group community that I'm a part of, we take vendor sponsorships through PayPal, and that's actually worked out pretty well for us. But
have you ever experienced a chargeback before?
No, but we haven't had to do those kinds of things either.
Yeah, I'm pretty much in the same boat. We bring in a lot of revenue through PayPal, which is yay for us. But I've not run into any major problems so far.
Yeah.
So it is.
This is the first time. This is the first time.
Yeah.
But when it hit, it's bad. So
right. Right.
And I haven't been involved in any real large ticket things either.
Chris, I think it's a good warning. I mean, if you got a credit card dispute with your bank, every bank handles that a little bit differently, and you can also get kind of tied up. Although I think the banks have a little better policy than PayPal would. Most banks are with, I think, about 21 days before they get hot and heavy after it.
Two and a half months is kind of ridiculous.
That is a long time. So. Yeah, that is a long time. Well, guys, I do. I'm going to wrap this a little bit early tonight. We've all had long days, and Chris, I know you've been on the road for some long traveling. You're back home tomorrow, though?
Yep, early tomorrow. I'm very excited to get back to St. Louis.
Yeah, good for you. Thanks for taking the time to reach out to the hotel room. I'm glad that change in time probably worked a little bit better for you. I got you maybe a little bit later in the evening than having to go so early.
Yep, worked great.
Good. Glad to be here. I appreciate it. Gary, thanks for filling in for Christian again. Tell him we missed him.
Anytime.
I'm sure he's grinding away on his homework and such. Next week, just if you're listening, next week's going to be another odd week for me. I'm not sure we're actually going to get a podcast in. So, again, watch Twitter, @JayCollison. I'll try and get a note out on the site if I can as well. I am doing some traveling myself. Ironically, I'm heading out to Wisconsin, and I'm going to be miles, just a few miles from Dave McCabe, but Dave McCabe will be down in Mexico. And so I will not. Dave, of course, is the host of the Home Server show and a good friend of mine, and I was hoping to see him. I'm there on some business, but he is away on vacation, so I guess I'll have to just do business. We may try and do the Home Tech Podcast remote from there. I'll just have to see how the technology goes, and I might just take a week off. We'll just have to see. Thanks to everybody in the stream that came out tonight to stay late. Actually, a pretty strong crowd out there this evening for Thursday night, and I appreciate you guys and what you do. Thanks for those folks that let me know that they listen on iTunes. I said in the beginning of the show I was going to read those, and I won't now. I'll save them up maybe for next week, and we'll get to those letters. And appreciate the positive comments. It's nice to know that some folks are listening out there. And if you do have a topic you'd like us to talk about, something you'd like us to cover, send me an email, podcast@theaverageguy.tv. That'll do it again for this. That'll do it for this episode of episode 61, Home Tech Podcast. We'll do it all again next week. Everybody have a good night.
Night, Jim.
Good night.